Welcome to our special year-end episode, The World Next Year. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
In this special, we'll take stock of what happened around the world in the extraordinary year of 2020, but also project forward to discuss some of the leading foreign policy challenges of 2021.
Joining us for this episode of the podcast is Shannon O'Neill. Shannon is the Vice President, Deputy Director of Studies, and Nelson and David Rockefeller Senior Fellow for Latin America Studies at CFR. She is an expert on Latin America, global trade, U.S.-Mexico relations, corruption, democracy, and immigration. Shannon, as always, a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thanks, Jim and Bob. It's always great to be here.
Well, Shannon, we're going to kick off by looking back, we have to, at 2020. We all have to do this in separate locations. You're communicating via audio software and Zoom. So between the pivotal elections that occurred around the world, the coronavirus pandemic, and so many other things, 2020 felt more than ever like a year of shared global problems. Shannon, can you discuss what you see as some of the biggest foreign policy challenges that emerged in the year, including the obvious, and also what we're going to have to grapple with in the year ahead?
Sure. Well, again, thanks for having me. It's always fun to join you all. And yeah, 2020, it's really hard to know where to start. I think 2020 is going to become a shorthand for when things go wrong looking forward. But yes, that was no exception on the foreign policy realm. So let me throw out three ideas and then we can talk about it. But three things that I think really shaped 2020 that will go into 2021. And so, you know, the most obvious one, we're going to leave COVID aside because we can talk about that later. But the most obvious to me was U.S. politics. You know, this was a year that started with Trump being impeached and it's ending with a transition and preparing for a new Biden administration. And so it was a year when the U.S. political establishment was absorbed with their own internal and somewhat vitriolic back and forth. And that really left a vacuum on the foreign policy arena. And a lot happened and the U.S. really just wasn't paying attention. So I think that's sort of one of the big challenges. Hopefully that's rectified in 2021, but we'll see. The second issue that we did see some movement, and I don't think in a really encouraging direction, is in U.S.-China relations. And 2020 was a really tough year for those issues. And we'd had a, you know, so-called trade war going on for a few years now, tariffs back and forth between the two countries. We'd had seen some sanctions in the years before, but 2020 was really when sanctions solidified. We saw an expansion of the companies that were being shut out of U.S. technology or U.S. or other companies couldn't work with them. We saw the U.S. expand and start taking on financial markets, trying to push Chinese companies out of the U.S. stock exchanges and the like. And we saw China reciprocate and set up their own unreliable entities lists or other things to keep out U.S. companies. So those borders started to harden and, you know, other players around the world got into the game too. We saw the U.K. being front-leaning on that and deciding to, you know, they need to kick Huawei out of all of their telecommunication systems in the coming number of years and other countries start to pull back. So this hardening is something that really, I think, took form in 2020 and will continue into 2021. And the last one I'll put on the plate, and then I'd love to hear what you all are thinking about in the foreign policy realm, is, you know, 2020 was a year actually when, and a little the different take here, is when the Me Too movement continued and spread globally. And so, you know, we forget because it feels like decades ago, but in February, Harvey Weinstein was convicted of rape and sexual assault against a number of women. And this really was part of a very high profile event covered in the US, but covered all around the world and is really a showcase for a movement that over the last few years has spread globally. And, you know, two of my great colleagues have a book that's coming out this spring, Rachel Vogelstein and Megan Stone, on these issues and really on the movements around the world. And it started perhaps in the US, but it's moved around the world. And interestingly, Harvey Weinstein's trial, we saw how global this movement is. And so while the reporters and everyone else was in there in the courtroom, they could hear outside hundreds of US women performing a song, a chant that was actually created by the Me Too movement in Chile, an artist down there that's really gone global. So I think this issue and the challenges women face, we've seen movement forward. We've seen a huge backlash too all around the world. These are issues that will continue into 2021. But what do you guys have on your list?
Yeah, Shannon, you covered the gamut of politics, you know, social and cultural changes and big power rivalry as well in the midst of it. I mean, I guess I would just add, I think permeating a lot of these issues was the impact of the pandemic. I remember early on as it was spreading, as it was becoming known that this was a real thing that we had to brace for, our colleague Tom Boyke saying that, you know, pandemics have a way of holding up a mirror in front of society. And, you know, the image looking back at us has, in the United States has been a pretty ugly one, I must say. And some of the reasons for that, I think, run through what you were talking about, you know, whether it's the politics and the divisions that really came out of those. Some of it was the resentment or the backlash against some of the Me Too things, that, you know, the concern about so-called cancel culture and so forth, and what that meant for, you know, where you stood on various issues, right down to whether you're going to wear a mask or not. And here we sit in mid-December, and you are still, some parts of the United States, it's seen as a mark of pride and almost a battle cry dealing with the use of a mask in the middle of a furious second wave of a pandemic. So I just think that is like the stamp for me on this year is really that mirror, reflecting on it and seeing what we've learned from it.
I know, I have to say, Bob and Shannon, I feel like 2020 had too much news, too many events. I'm sort of overwhelmed. And I'm struck, Shannon, you began by mentioning that in 2020, we had the impeachment and an impeachment trial of an American president. Normally, that would be the biggest issue of the year. At this point, it's even hard to remember that it happened this year. And we can go on. I think you've both put on the table lots of important events. I would add the Black Lives Matter movement, the killing of George Floyd, which resonated not just here in the United States, but around the world. I live in Washington, D.C., so I got to go down to and participate in the protests, the vigils, and it was quite moving. And I think anyone who had a chance to see the artwork that people put up on the fences that were put up around the White House would be struck by the depth of the sorrow, the anger, but I think also sort of the inspiration, the hope that, in fact, America can live up to who we say we are as a people. But, you know, going outside of those issues, we obviously had big progress in the Middle East with the Abraham Accords. I wouldn't say they're as significant as the peace treaty between Israel and Egypt or with Jordan or the Oslo Accords, but they are significant and may lead to some reshaping in the region, though they don't solve the issue between Israel and the Palestinians. We've also seen protests around the world, most notably in Belarus, where people took to the streets demanding a free and fair vote. Fortunately, liberal Russians haven't got their way yet. And also sort of a continuation of a story we've talked about a lot, which is the growing evidence of climate change, the disruption it is causing around the world, and our inability to step up, acknowledge that it is happening, and to do something about it. I'll do a shout out to our colleague, Alice Hill, who has a book to be coming out this year on climate change, on what can be done to adapt to it. Because the fact is, climate disruption is already here. Yes, we have to reduce emissions. Hopefully, we'll make progress on that and not make progress simply by having the economy go off the cliff because of a pandemic. But there are also numerous ways which we have to change our lives because the climate is changing and it has consequences for our food, for our security, for our health, and so forth. But again, I still think 2020 had more news than I can handle.
Agreed on that. How do you see 2021? Are we going to make progress on climate or any other issues you brought up? Or how do you see it going forward?
Well, certainly the incoming Biden administration is hoping it can make a difference. The president-elect has talked about how America is back. He is going to re-embrace multilateralism, build up a coalition of like-minded countries to tackle these big common transnational problems. The jury's out, though, that he's going to be able to make much progress, in part because he faces stiff winds here at home. We have divided government. We have big challenges abroad besides climate change. You talked about the U.S.-China rivalry, which I think is only going to continue and perhaps heat up. Meanwhile, many people are going to expect a President Biden to attend to domestic issues at home, which actually leads me to ask you a question, Shannon, since you spend a lot of time thinking about trade, not just with our partners in Mexico, but elsewhere. And you too will have a book coming out in 2021. I have a draft manuscript here. It's entitled America First Puts America Last. At least that's a tentative title. I'm actually curious how you think the pandemic, the talk of decoupling with China is going to reshape our understanding of what used to be a boring topic, supply chains, but actually is pivotal to economic prosperity.
You know, these supply chains have been there for a long time. They developed over 30 or 40 years, but they've been changing over this last decade. And I would say this year, 2020, with COVID, with the tensions with China and the like, have just accelerated trends that have been underway since the financial crisis started in 2008, 2009. And so this is the onset of automation. This is the onset of robots moving in. This is the onset of wages rising in places like China. And it's the onset of tariffs and preferential trade agreements and others proliferating around the world and changing the decisions that are happening in boardrooms as to where companies want to put their manufacturing or different parts of their manufacturing process. And so we had already started to see a move out of China into other Asian and Southeast Asian countries starting throughout the 2010s. And that has picked up a lot this year. And as I look forward, especially with COVID, especially with the lockdowns and the shutdowns that we saw over this last year, I do think global supply chains, or at least regional supply chains, are here to stay. But we're going to see a rejiggering. We're going to see a movement around the world and people placing different operations in different places, thinking about both the profit and loss, right? Whether they can make money where they put it, but they're also going to be thinking a little bit more about the politics and the national security implications here, which hasn't really been the main discussion in boardrooms, I would say, back at least at the start of the century. So that is going to be a change from 2021 on for companies as they look to make things that we all buy.
I think that's a great through line from 2020 to 2021, the supply chain issue. It's an underrated issue. As you say, Shannon, they're here to stay. You know, I've seen in some places already saying it's the great triumph story of so far what's happened with the vaccines. Unheard of, you know, development of two that we're looking at right now, two coronavirus vaccines that are being rolled out that benefited from the infrastructure that, you know, created through global supply chains and the ability of massive international pharmaceutical companies, buttressed in some cases by government funding, to make this happen. Then it's a question of, you know, is there the political will to make these supply chains really work in terms of disseminating, distributing efficiently vaccines to billions of people? I mean, do you see it? Are you concerned about that and what our colleagues have called vaccine nationalism playing a role?
Yeah, I mean, global supply chains, I think, is actually the way that we're all going to get out of our living rooms or our bedrooms, as the case for me here in this podcast, is that the way you're going to be able to have billions of vaccines available out there in the next several months is because of global supply chains. That's how it's actually going to work. Because as you look at it, you need precursors. So you have the amazing medicine breakthroughs and the like, and those are great stories of immigrants or second generation immigrants who came together right across the world with the science. But now you need the pieces and parts to come together. And the only way it's going to happen really quickly is if you bring in all countries involved. And that's everything from the chemical precursors that you need to go into these vaccines to the sort of more mundane, the glass vials that each vaccine is going to be held in, or the syringes that those nurses and doctors are going to use in hospitals throughout the US and around the world. And no country around the world makes enough of each of those things to do it themselves. So I think vaccine nationalism is more of a health threat to us today than something that will help protect our population, because you need things that are made all around the world to come together in a very intricate dance and manufacturing dance to be able to make sure all of us get a chance to have a vaccine or two in the case of Pfizer and some of these in the months that come.
So Shannon, how is this going to work if countries are going to have incentives to want to inoculate their people first, their citizens first? That means that countries that can produce it are going to be able to take care of themselves. But for the vast swath of humanity, they don't have governments that are able to produce this. Yet they're still dealing with the consequences of it. I mean, you study Latin America very closely. It's been ravaged by COVID-19, but it doesn't have its own innate production capacity to produce, whether it's the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine or the Moderna vaccine or the Pfizer vaccine or a number of others that are likely to come into the market. So how do you deal with this issue of equity, especially given that if you can't snuff out the virus around the world, it's likely to come back into your own country once you open up its borders?
So one challenge is this manufacturing process. And there you're actually starting to see plants set up around the world. So Mexico has some plants, Brazil has some plants. And the challenge there will be, can they get the raw materials into their plants to make the vaccines? And those aren't necessarily made in those countries, right? Or in our country, frankly, here in the United States or anywhere else. They're made all over the world. So where do you get the glass? Where do you get the needles? Where do you get the chemicals and all of that? That's a first challenge. You know, the other challenge is buying these vaccines. And that is somewhere that a lot of emerging economies have much less buying power than the United States or the EU or others, and particularly those that are, you know, we're able in the United States because of lots of reasons to really run up the debt as much as we want, at least in the short to medium term. That's not the case in most countries around the world because they're not based on the dollar, nor do they control the dollar or the euro or a couple other vital currencies. So the real challenge, I think the real challenge for Latin American countries, but many emerging economies out there is, one, do you have enough money and access to get the source that you need? need? And then two, can you deliver it to your population? And there's sort of two challenges. One is a capacity issue. Do you have the health clinics? Are you able, especially with a lot of these vaccines, you need to keep them incredibly cold. Do you have the right specialty freezers or others across the whole process to get it to someone who lives not just in the capital city, but way out in a more rural area? So I think one challenge is just that health capacity. The other challenge is, frankly, in some of these countries is political will. They will spend enough money and have enough effort to make sure 10 to 20% of the population, the elites, get vaccinated. But do they really have enough money and momentum to make sure that everybody gets vaccinated, even people who often don't have as strong a voice within the political system? And, you know, I'd love to ask the two of you. So this is a challenge in emerging markets, but what's going to happen here in the United States? Because as I start looking through a lot of these issues, we're going to have our own distribution channels. And what I've seen so far is that the federal government was involved in getting the vaccine produced or the science behind it and then buying it, but then they're turning everything over to the states. So how do you see this sort of federalist system working or not working as we try to get the 330 million or so Americans vaccinated?
Well, Shannon, there, I think the operating principle is you hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. I mean, let's face it, any rollout of this size, this complexity is going to have its missteps. What you're hoping is that you can identify the missteps early on and then adapt your plan to take that into account. What complicates this, of course, is that we're going to be having this rollout and having a presidential transition at the same time. There are real questions about how well the outgoing Trump administration is coordinating with the incoming Biden administration, which lays another level of complexity on your concern, which is coordinating federal, state, and local, then adding in all the scientific things, such as, it may seem trivial, but how do you keep the Pfizer vaccine at minus 70 degrees Fahrenheit? The thing is, if it doesn't, it thaws and then it goes bad. But there's also this real question of how will people react to the opportunity to get vaccinated? If you look at public opinion polls, there's a substantial chunk of Americans who say, I'm not interested in getting vaccinated. And that number could go up depending upon how events unfold. Any vaccination program of this scope, and we're talking about vaccinating an entire country over the course of the next year, means that you could have somebody get vaccinated, fall ill, and then you'll have stories about how it led to an adverse reaction, leading some people to back off. And besides those sort of stories, which may just be coincidental, you really do run the risk of having false information out there with stories that have no relationship in truth, arguing that a particular vaccine has certain side effects. And again, we have seen over the last 3, 4, 5 years how social media operates. Truth doesn't win out. Sort of the most lurid, most incendiary, most impassioned charges stick. They get circulated, and that's going to gum up the works. I think the challenge for the Biden administration, because they're the ones that are going to be overseeing the rollout for the longest period of time, is how do you deal with the behavioral aspects of a rollout plan where people don't act the way an economist thinks? They make a cost-benefit analysis, and they decide that the shot is 95% effective, and they get it done. You're going to have a lot of people who, for a lot of reasons, are going to say, I am not interested. And that's going to be the big public health challenge out there. Because what scientists tell us is that we need to get north of 70% of the population to be inoculated in order to get this so-called herd mentality. Whereas the people who haven't been vaccinated are so few in number that it's hard for the virus to pass along. But it may be a long time before we get there, you know, under the best of circumstances, and we may not get there. People recoil and say, I don't want to get it.
Yeah, I was just going to say that information piece is really looming large. And as you say, Jim, the social media environment, the distrust environment, I mean, we've just gone through a political season which a not insignificant number of Republicans think the election was stolen from President Trump. And we just had, you know, within the last couple of days, the Senate Majority Leader acknowledged President-elect Biden is the president-elect. And big questions about how much of the country is willing to follow a Biden administration's guidelines, because it seems very clear that unlike the Trump administration, you're going to see a lot more federally led directives, you know, even though things are going to have to, you know, sort of pan out locally in state and local levels. There will be a lot more guidance from the federal level, probably a more empowered CDC and so forth, laying out guidelines for the vaccine for, you know, and it's also a two-step process. It's maybe rough enough just to take one vaccine. People actually have to come back and take it a second time. There's so many areas where this could be a really fraught exercise, but at the same time, it's also seen by many as the path out of this mess and towards what Tony Fauci has said is, you know, a herd immunity process that will allow, you know, some sense of normalcy to return.
You know, both the things you just brought up bring me to another point, slight shift. And when I've listened to your podcast in the past, you talk a lot about these issues, this misinformation and disinformation. And I have to say, over the last few months, I've started to hear another term, this infodemic, which is a little bit jargony. It doesn't quite roll off the tongue so much, but I hear a lot about it in this health space and then more broadly. Could you all talk a little bit about, have you heard about this? And, you know, what are people really talking about? What's the concept here that people are laying out that's different than, say, misinformation or disinformation?
Bob, you're the journalist by training, and you're the one responsible for spreading new terms. So I want you to answer Shannon's question.
I would be happy to, Jim. On this one, I defer partly on the terms of the definition of infodemic to a collection of UN agencies that put out statements actually throughout the pandemic warning of the problem because it is seen as so corrosive. And there was a statement that this batch of UN agencies put out basically saying infodemic is what Jim referred to earlier, this sort of overabundance of information, this saturation of information online and offline that involves deliberate attempts to disseminate wrong information. So that's disinformation. As well as maybe well-meaning but false information, misinformation. But the disinformation in particular is part of an infodemic because it's aimed at undermining public health responses and advancing instead the agendas of individuals or groups. And it has a malign impact. It has a serious impact. It can stop in their tracks important vaccination efforts, for example, or people to not observe proper public health measures. I was referencing the masks issue before. And so it really can play a role, this infodemic that's been cited repeatedly, can play a role in endangering countries' ability to stop the pandemic.
Well, I mean, this is an important point, Bob, because it gets to the question of where can you go for correct information? Who can you trust? Are there gatekeepers, that is, people who are valued in terms of providing responsible knowledge to the rest of us? And I think with the rise of social media, with the rise of the internet, those traditional gatekeepers have been swept away. And that's why you have this flood of information. No matter where you go, you can find something. And how many times have you had a conversation with somebody where you question what they said, and they say, but I saw it on the internet. And they talk about what a fancy web page it was. But the reality is that the thing about the internet is everybody gets to speak in the public square. And so the fact that information exists doesn't make it true, but how do you know what is true and what isn't? And it's further complicated by the fact that experts, however determined and honest and dedicated they may be, they get stuff wrong. So let's look at the pandemic. The message about masks has changed over time. Early on, they were doubting the utility of masks, perhaps partly because there was a shortage of masks. They wanted frontline workers to get it, but perhaps because people really hadn't thought through. They were thinking of masks as protecting individuals from getting the disease, as opposed to people who were ill wearing masks, sort of no longer being able to transmit it as efficiently. But as time went on, you learn more. And that's the nature of science. I mean, science is like you do experiments, you learn, and you correct the things you thought were true that aren't true, and you move forward. But in this world we live in, people take those errors, what I would call good faith errors, and weaponize them. They turn it into question the credibility. You can't trust the experts. You can't trust the journalists. You can't trust the government official. And the problem is, if you don't have trust, it's very hard to see how you can make a democracy function well, because democracy depends on some modicum of trust, and it depends upon having good information. And I think all of that is up for grabs right now.
Yeah, those are all really good points, Jim. I would just say we are looking at, among the many crises playing out around the world, there's a crisis in journalism. And coming into this year, if you had asked me about what do I think of the internet, I would have said, oh, it's the best of times, it's the worst of times, right? It's you got more valuable information at your fingertips for free than in the history of civilization. But by the same time, it was also kind of the Wild West and lots of misinformation out there and increasing levels of trolling and social media misbehavior and everything else. I have to add to that, given that this public health crisis, this existential crisis in a lot of ways, it's time for a reckoning with the way people are getting information. And it can't all be laid at journalism's feet. It can't all be laid at social media institutions' feet. But I think if you look at, there have been reams of studies produced about this problem. And among the things you see are, immediate steps involving the responsibility of social media gatekeepers, the massive, mostly U.S. tech companies that are the platforms for information coming out, the Facebooks and Google and YouTube. YouTube and so forth, playing a role in taking off dangerously misleading information. They've been trying to do that. They've been starting to do that. There's increasing mandates coming out. I think the European Union is the next in line, that they have a whole raft of things they're going to start requiring the big tech companies to do to be able to function in the EU countries, for example. But it's not everything, because it's still, as we've seen, there's plenty of places people will go to get the information that they feel most comfortable. It's everybody's echo chamber, right? So it's also the sort of generational challenge of creating a more discerning, educated public. And, you know, that's not going to happen overnight either. And so I read a really interesting piece, it's now a couple of years old, from Jonathan Rauch, where he refers to something called the Constitution of Knowledge, which is sort of this collection of bodies that has its own sort of checks and balances on separation of powers through which information is distributed in a sort of coherent way. The checks and balances allow for corrections. So a journalism organization gets something wrong, it goes out and puts a correction out, or it follows up and reports on something else, or there's peer review and replication in academia. There's governing institutions that come forward with important studies. And then there's voting to sort of, you know, to sort of validate some of the moves that are made by elites in various societies. And, you know, all of that, according to Rauch and the piece I read, seems to support that despite all the challenges, that the constitution of knowledge will prevail at the end of the day. We saw a little of this, and we'll get into this further. We saw a little of this with the U.S. elections that have played out, where there actually was a set path for vote tallies to be taken and for them to be responsibly measured and for challenges to be made and so forth. We should also note that in the U.S. elections, there was this unbelievable turnout in the middle of a pandemic that showed that there is great interest among Americans to have their voices heard. And so 67% of the eligible public voting. So I guess I would end on a slightly positive note in that there seems to be a desire for improving the situation now, but for the two sort of pitted sides against each other in the U.S. in particular, but really internationally, there's going to have to be a sort of greater coalescing around better media, more responsible media, and a path towards sort of checking out sources. I think at the end of the day, if you have a sourcing and agreed upon way of checking out sources for information, it's going to take you a long way. It's not going to happen, though, in the short term.
Bob, I want to get into the question of the election. But before I do that, I want to ask Shannon a question. Now, maybe an unfair question, Shannon, so you can ask it back at me if you want. But, you know, faced with this infodemic, how do you go about determining what's legitimate information and what's fake information? Any advice you have, sort of how you navigate this world in which people tell you things, some of which are crazy and literally are?
Well, I have to say, I, you know, have to double check the things I get on WhatsApp. That's not my first stop, nor Facebook. And they're all owned by the same company. So, you know, that's one source, right? So multiple sources. You know, I'm kind of old school. I like to go with the old bylines that people have heard of. They can be from all over the political spectrum, right? It could be New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, or the Financial Times, or Foreign Affairs, or Foreign Policy, or there's lots of others out there. But I think, you know, the best you can do is to triangulate and see what a lot of different people are saying and see where it comes together and where there's some overlap. And hopefully if it's coming from different sides, if you end up somewhere in that Goldilocks middle, it works. But, you know, I have to say, it's interesting. I have two girls who are 12 and 10, and they're starting to look into these things, and they read things, and then they start asking questions and analyzing and seeing if it's true or not. And we have discussions about how one might know if it was true or if it's not true. So I think I have more faith in this next generation coming up and their ability to distinguish facts from fiction than perhaps I sometimes do in the milieu that we all live in. But how about you all? How do you begin your day when you get deluged with all of this news and information?
Well, I'm a lot like you, Shan, in that I triangulate. I read lots of different pieces from lots of different outlets, some conservative, some liberal, some in the middle of the road, in part because you're trying to sort of get the whole story. And I mean, I begin with the assumption that no reporter is going to get every aspect of the story straight. And so what you're trying to do is to sort of piece things together. That's why I read people across the opinion spectrum to get sort of different views. But I got to note, this is my living. It's our living. This is what we do. We've been doing it for a long time. You and I both have PhDs, sort of natural for anybody who's an academic to read a lot of stuff and try to figure out where they match and where they're off. And you can then try to figure out like it's a puzzle. But I think for most people, they're busy. They're doing things. They have their kids. They have their hobbies, their sports teams, the books they want to read. And the notion of investing, you know, a half an hour, let alone an hour, a half a day, trying to keep abreast of all that's going on. on, they just sort of throw their hands up in the air. I think that's what I really worry about. I mean, I do think that for a lot of people can be taught critical thinking skills, but in a problem in which information comes at you like a fire hose, it can really sort of be overwhelming. And the easiest thing to do is say, hey, what's on Netflix? I'm going to watch The Queen's Gambit and let it all pass by. And I think that's the challenge you have to do, is to get it a citizenry involved enough. Now, I do think on some big issues, the evidence is people do try to learn and some learning takes place.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Jim. I think it's, as a living, I am constantly parsing through information I'm getting. I subscribe to far too many newsletters. But by the end of a morning of after I'm cross-eyed, I do have a sense on balance of things that are happening and a pretty good confidence that those things that were reported did in fact happen or are happening, et cetera. But I do think, you know, this combination of this infodemic situation and this partisan divide, on top of it, following years of erosion, just the plummeting of local news sources, of media sources that had been the traditional sources. So Jim used the term gatekeeper, you know, and there was a, not too long ago, what there was a time when it was a combination of the local newspaper that as a citizen, you felt pretty comfortable in writing to or calling, even if you had an issue with something they wrote. There was on the network television, even during the cable period, you had this bit of an oligarchy of just a handful of sources that, while maybe didn't cover everything you were interested in, but when they covered something, there was a kind of a thoroughness and admittedly some bias in certain channels, you knew kind of where they kind of leaned in certain issues or not. But again, at the end of the day, they would be reporting on something in a straightforward fashion. Documentaries were a lot more something that was sort of shared around and shared in classrooms and so forth. And now when you go to a source, it's sort of like, where's that source getting from? Are they pro-Trump? Are they anti-Trump? Are they progressive bias or whatever? And so right away, you start out with a set of assumptions about the source, and it gets back to that trust issue. And so I think if we can take steps to sort of shore up our media environment, partly through checking the platforms, and there's been a lot of discussion of this Section 230 of the Communication Decency Act, which is about protecting internet providers from being sued for content. But if there's going to be something that can be done to create a reckoning or create some accountability for what is disseminated on these massive platforms for information, I think that can help a lot in sort of getting a handle on what's coming in. Like you, Shannon, I'm in touch with my daughters about where they're getting the information and what they should believe and what the credible sources are. And they're interested now. I have their attention because they're marooned at home in a pandemic and they want to know why. You know, and so instead of blowing some smoke about what's really happening, they clear enough, they can see, you know, different things happening, different spikes in COVID, in different parts of the country or places that they maybe wanted to travel to or have friends who they wanted to see. Again, they're very focused on this. And so they want to know where the information is coming from. And so I think if we can use this crisis in a way to sort of rededicate ourselves to science, to health science, I would think there would be a portion of the country, may not be the numbers that we'd like, but a portion of the country that is newly sort of concerned and newly aware of what the best sources are for information on science, on health, and things like that.
Well, you've renewed my optimism about the next generation. So good parenting.
It's not just TikTok, I promise.
So, Jim, given all this, we now are in the countdown toward the inauguration of President-elect Biden, January 20th. You have been busily talking through the consequences of the election and the world that's facing, the inbox, shall we say, that's facing President-elect Biden. The sister podcast of ours, President's Inbox, that you host, has dealt with a lot of the big issues so far. And I really recommend people listen to the episodes on restoring alliances in China, for example. The Middle East is the latest episode. So, Jim, as you get through these discussions, what are some of your takeaways about the biggest foreign policy challenges that the country's facing in 2021?
I'm going to answer that question, Bob, but before I do that, I want to make a preceding observation, which is when you look back at 2020, you're quite right. We saw really record voter turnout. You mentioned 66.7% of the voting age population turned out to vote. And in many ways, that's a good news story because it says people are engaged in democracy. They cared a lot. And I'll note that this is the highest turnout we've seen percentage terms since 1900. So pretty significant. However, I would also note that in the conversation during the campaign, foreign policy hardly played a role. The coronavirus, President Trump's behavior, the economy, jobs, lockdowns, healthcare, those were the driving issues. And so 2020, in that sense, was a very typical presidential election. There's an old saying that foreign policy doesn't drive or decide presidential elections, but presidential elections decide foreign policy. Very much true in 2020. Joe Biden ran on a policy of essentially running away from Donald Trump's America First and instead embracing multilateralism, trying to organize others in common cause to attack challenges, particularly the challenge posed by the rise in China. And what I will say in talking to, you know, a lot of our colleagues and other experts on these issues as part of the Transition 2021 series on the President's Inbox, I will say, one, Joe Biden is coming into office facing a daunting foreign policy inbox. There are lots of challenges. I could spend the next 20 minutes just listing them. And I will note that a common trait many of these challenges face, whether we're talking about China or North Korea or Iran or Afghanistan, I keep going on the list, is that these are foreign policy problems that bedeviled not just the Trump administration, but administrations before that. These are mostly challenges that defy easy resolution. Indeed, in many cases, I don't think you'd expect any American president to, quote, fix them, but rather to find ways to manage them or to mitigate them. I think that begin there. Second thing I will say is that Joe Biden comes into office with this big plate of issues, and they aren't even the politically most relevant ones for his presidency. Again, Americans elected him because they want him to address their domestic challenges, inequality, systemic racism, jobs, and broader concern about where this country is headed. Again, if you look at public opinion polls, many Americans say they are worried about the future for their children. They want somebody to make decisions to improve their situation. And it's taking place in the context of a pandemic in which some people, knowledge workers like ourselves, have done reasonably well, have been insulated from what's happening because they can work remotely. And a large chunk of Americans, people working in essential services who will need to be on the job, hotels, restaurants, airlines, are being devastated by this economic crisis because they don't have the option of opting out. In fact, many of them are seeing their jobs go away. Third point I'll make about the foreign policy inbox is that Joe Biden faces strong headwinds in trying to get something done. He faces strong headwinds because he has determined adversaries overseas, but he also at home faces a divided country. Partisanship and politicization is not going to go away on January 20th. Joe Biden is the first president since George H.W. Bush to come into office and not have his party control both chambers of Congress. Indeed, he's the first Democratic president since Grover Cleveland back in the 1890s to come into office and not having his fellow Democrats control the House and Senate. So politically, he's going to face a big challenge. And at the same time, he's also going to be going into uncharted waters. Everything we can see about how this election has played out with Donald Trump denying the legitimacy of Joe Biden's victory, Donald Trump's refusing to concede, Donald Trump talking about wanting to remain relevant, is he's very likely in the months to come after Inauguration Day to be using Twitter and other means to attack Joe Biden, to attack his decisions. We haven't seen anything like that in American history. And it matters because Donald Trump very clearly has hold of the Republican mind. He is able to move and constrain the behavior of Republican policymakers. So Joe Biden is going to have a very hard time trying to translate his campaign promises into realities. And that's why I actually want to ask Shannon a question, because candidate Biden talked a lot about Latin America. You think he has some big plans for Mexico. You obviously spend time thinking about the region. How do you think the relationship between Washington and Mexico City is going to go under Biden's leadership?
In one word, poorly.
Okay.
But I'm happy to elaborate on that.
Please elaborate.
So López Obrador, the president of Mexico, was one of the last, not the last, that will reserve that for the president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, who's the last president around the world to congratulate Joe Biden. But AMLO, López Obrador's the president, came in right before him and after Putin congratulating President-elect. So already there was a distance that formed. You don't have sort of a camaraderie or bonhomie. But really more important is that many of the things that Joseph Biden stands for and that he's already talked about in his campaigns and is signaling with his transition team are things that are going to be really difficult for the U.S.-Mexico relationship. So Biden administration is going to care a lot about climate change. And this is an administration in Mexico and probably one of the only ones all over the world that is actively investing to take their energy matrix back to a much dirtier fossil fuel based one. So cutting out renewables, which is really going to be a key element of where the new U.S. administration is headed. The new administration and the Democrats in Congress are also going to care a lot about labor issues in Mexico. Mexico, and the new USMCA has mechanisms for them to get much more involved on a domestic level that have yet to be used, but they're going to use them. And that too is going to cause some discomfort south of the border as the AMLO administration deals with US interests and US labor unions and others getting involved in what's happening on the ground in companies within Mexico. You're going to see Democrats in Congress as well as the Biden administration care a lot more about anti-corruption efforts and seeing prosecutions and seeing movement forward on those things, which Mexico, the president there has talked a lot about it, but hasn't really done much on the ground. You know, one of the most interesting and quite depressing on my particular view is we recently, the Trump administration sent back the former defense minister who was accused of corruption, money laundering and the like by prosecutors in New York. He was brought up here and was awaiting trial, and the Trump administration sent him back. And so far, the Mexican government has done nothing with the charges, but did demand him back. And then we're also going to see some tensions between the two governments on security issues more broadly. And Mexico actually this week just passed a law that will make it really hard for any U.S. law enforcement agents to work in Mexico. It stripped them basically of diplomatic immunity and also won't allow them to talk to people within the Mexican administration without filing reports. Any information they get, they have to hand over to the foreign ministry. A lot of things that just won't make it possible. So there's going to have to be a total rethink about the way security cooperation works. And then the last thing I would throw on that agenda, and you know, Jim laid out a very imposing and somewhat grim agenda for the Biden administration, but this involves Mexico, but isn't solely Mexico, is that one of the first foreign policy crises, but really domestic crises that may hit the Biden administration is Central American migration. And so we have seen the Trump administration struggle with this over the last 4 years. Over a million Central Americans have left their country. Trump has done it in a pretty punitive way, and Mexico has been keeping many of those Central Americans or deporting them back to Central America. You're going to see a huge movement of more Central Americans moving north. One, because COVID has just devastated their economies. Two, because in the last couple of months, we've seen not one, but two hurricanes devastate big parts of these countries and over 500,000, half a million people losing their homes and communities. So they're already on the move. And three, I think you also see some hope in Central America that a Biden administration is going to be a bit kinder and gentler to asylum seekers and others. And this idea is being promoted by the coyotes and the human traffickers that move them up because they need to make some money. It's been a rough season for them. So I think all of these are going to come together and lead to real challenges with the Central American countries where they're coming from, but with Mexico, where almost all of them move through. And so we're going to see challenges at the border. And then it becomes a domestic crisis because you have tens of thousands of women and children and others who are at the border. And I can't see a Biden administration putting these kids in cages. That's not going to be the policy. But they're inheriting a very broken immigration system that doesn't give them a lot of tools to manage these flows of people. So that is going to be top of the U.S.-Mexico agenda as well.
That's a really interesting last point, especially Shannon. And I thought it was interesting how AMLO and Trump reached a sort of modus operandi in terms of the migration issue. It's kind of surprising if you think about the way Trump came into office and his open disdain for Mexico that they ended up at that place. And Trump, it should be noted, inherited a very complicated, messy situation involving migration at the border. The Obama administration itself had gained, I think, a reputation for pretty hardline policy on deporting people and so forth, although it wasn't putting children in cages or anything. And so, as you say, I think President-elect Biden has already signaled he's going to increase the levels of those who can gain asylum to the country, maybe to over 100,000 or something thereabouts. So I think all of that makes that very interesting. It will be worth noting whether there's new emphasis on trying to shore up source countries that are experiencing all these problems and that people are fleeing from in droves, which was something that Trump, you know, showed very little interest in at the end of the day in terms of trying to bolster the economies of the so-called Northern Triangle countries and so forth. Do you see that happening under Biden?
So Biden has already promised on the campaign that he would invest $4 billion over the 4 years, a billion a year. So that is a big push that he's already thinking about. And he was actually leading the 2014 U.S. effort under the Obama administration when there was a previous wave of people coming up from Central America. But in many ways, this gets back to domestic U.S. politics, what happens in Georgia in the weeks to come, and whether he can get a big bill like that and support for Central America through the U.S. Congress.
Shannon, I want to thank you for raising the issue of potential migration crisis at the border, because I think it highlights three important things that people need to keep in mind in terms of Biden's overall foreign policy agenda. One, we tend to have a conceit that presidents get to decide what they want to do. Well, news is events decide what you have to do. And I think, you know, besides a migration crisis at the border, you could have an early test of ballistic missiles or nuclear weapons by North Korea. You could have the Iranians forcing the issue on the Iran nuclear deal. You could have a crisis in the South China Sea or over Taiwan. So events really matter. Second thing is the migration crisis at the border is sort of a poster child, if I could use that term, for how messy so many problems are. That is, they don't have simple solutions, not just a matter of doing B rather than A in the problem solved. It has deep roots. Things are interconnected. Very hard to come up with solutions that A, really make a difference, but also be acceptable to large chunks of your domestic world. Third thing is, and we never should lose sight of this, transitions are difficult things in the United States. We're the only country that essentially replaces the entire top of our government. The Biden administration will, day one, have a lot of empty chairs throughout its foreign policy national security team. By the end of 2 weeks, we hope that a lot of the most senior positions are filled, but a lot of those other positions, think ambassadors, think deputy assistant secretary of states, undersecretaries, deputy secretaries, those are going to take months to fill. And a Biden team may not have a complete team until you get to summer, but the world is not going to sit idly by, sort of tapping its watch, waiting for America to get ready. The gun sounds on day one, and you have to be ready as a president to make decisions and handle crises on day one. Team Biden is about to set sail into very choppy seas. I wish him the best. Hope things go well.
You know, I would note one thing in addition to that, Jim, that's very well said. Biden enters office with probably the most foreign policy experience of any president since George H.W. Bush, longtime veteran Senate Foreign Relations Committee member, and with a understanding of U.S. alliance systems, with the nuances of foreign policy, knew quite a bit about the somewhat obscure area that I worked in for a number of years, which is U.S. international broadcasting. He comes into office with that repository of knowledge, with admittedly an incredible array of challenges facing him. But that is something that should stand him in good stead. At the same time, I think what looms as really daunting is what you laid out earlier, Jim, which is the array of domestic challenges. And as we all know, the domestic challenges were some of the things that undermined George H.W. Bush at the end of the day, serving just one term.
Well, Bob, you're right. That is a really deep experience. And lots of those that he's nominated that we've heard their names put forward also have an incredibly deep experience in foreign policy and domestic policy. So it looks like a great team that's coming in, and let's hope they can take on all of these challenges.
And with that, we'll wrap up The World Next Year. To all of our regular listeners, we hope you enjoyed this special episode of the podcast and that you'll tune in again on January 7th for our regular look at the world next week. Shannon, thanks so much for stopping by.
It was great to be here with you all.
My thanks as well, Shannon. Please subscribe to The World Next Week in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Special thanks to Anna Shortridge, Margaret Gatch, and Natalia Cote-Munoz for their assistance. Zoe Collis also served as a recording engineer for this week. Thank you, Zoe. Our theme music was provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and peace and health to everyone this season.